What if your lifelong health wasn't shaped by genetics the way we've always believed, but by something far more fluid, subtle, and intelligent? In this episode of Born to Know, I sit down with Dr. Mauro Zapatera, a Harvard-trained medical doctor and pioneer in the study of cerebral spinal fluid and amniotic intelligence. Together, we explore what he calls the brain's hidden river, a subtle yet powerful system that supports fetal development, reflects maternal emotion, and might even store our deepest memories and awareness. Until now, science has barely scratched the surface of what this fluid actually does, but today that changes. We'll uncover how cerebral spinal fluid shapes consciousness, how the womb experience imprints us for life, and how interventions like epidurals can alter this unseen system. You'll also learn how to reconnect with this fluid intelligence through awareness and intention. This is science meeting the soul, and you won't see your body the same way again. Dr. Zapatera, thank you so much for joining me today. I've been really looking forward to this conversation.
Thanks for hosting me. It's an honor.
It is an honor to speak with you. I've been following your work, and I know that you've spoken with some of my friends and colleagues like Alex Zeck, and that conversation you had with him was where I really got inspired to start diving more into your work. And I have my own musings about some of the things that you touch on, so I'm excited to chat today. And I would love to hear how you like what your journey was and how you felt inspired and fascinated by, diving deeper into cerebral spinal fluid and really like redefining the way that we perceive its power, its purpose, and its function.
Absolutely. It's quite a, let's say, convoluted journey, but when you look, retrospectively, it's quite beautiful. I was at Harvard Medical School. I was doing what's called an MD-PhD program. And what that is essentially you do 2 years of medical school, and then you take a break from medical school and you go and you do a PhD. And that can take anywhere between 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, depending on how long it takes you to do a PhD. And so I was starting my PhD, and I was interested in I think one of my problems is sort of I'm always interested in a lot of different things. So it was very difficult for me to choose something to do research on, because it was like any topic in medicine or regarding the human body was really fascinating to me. And I was interested in how cells grow. And so I picked a cancer lab, a lab that was doing research on cancer. And that's when I met my now wife during that time period. And we were hanging out, and she goes, "You don't seem too happy doing this. It seems like maybe the flame in your passion has been dimmed. Why don't we take some time off and go and study some different things in medicine or healing or self-healing or holistic body systems and stuff like that?" And so I was always interested in that. My mom was an acupressurist. She studied shiatsu massage. I was always interested in acupuncture and just sort of whole body, if you had a headache, doing pressure points on your feet or hands, or looking at the whole body as a whole. And so that it always kind of interested me. And my wife was interested in kind of going into a holistic healing modality herself. And so while I was in the lab, she was doing some Google searches and found this school in Santa Fe, New Mexico, called the New Mexico Academy of Healing Arts, which was in Santa Fe. And she found polarity therapy. And polarity therapy essentially is a holistic health system, let's say, that really focuses on body movement, so how we move, therapeutic touch, diet and nutrition, and then positive thinking. And so it sort of has those four main domains. And you know, just looking at it from a human perspective, I'm like, okay, well, we got to move. We got to, you know, we got to see what our thoughts are. We got to take care of our nutrition and what we're getting into our bodies. And then therapeutic touch was always something that was interesting to me, more from like a massage perspective, not really an energy medicine perspective. But I was always interested in my friends of, you know, heat transfer or auras or, you know, even being able to, let's say, transmit energy through through some sort of force of, you know, Tai Chi, Qigong, things like that. And so I wasn't opposed to it. And I was very open to those sorts of things. And so my wife and I are then, you know, we were dating, but she essentially made me take time off from medical school, which from this MD PhD program, which I thought was impossible. And she said, you know, just ask, you're not happy, we got to do something. And initially I was like, okay, cool. Like, I'm going to have a vacation, right? Well, you go and learn these things. I'm going to, like, kind of through osmosis, learn about it with you, but I'm not taking these classes. She's like, no, you're taking these classes. And I'm like, but I don't want to take, can I just, like, have time off? Like, maybe it's just a time for me to reflect and, you know, you go off and do the trainings and stuff. And she's like, no, you're doing them with me. And so I did. And initially it was like a 4-week program. And then we liked it so much that we ended up doing the entire training. And during that training, you know, if you've ever done sort of any body work training, you're not only doing the training and you're learning about the philosophy of the training. So you're learning about not only like anatomy and physiology, but I didn't really need that because I was already in med, you know, I'd already gone through all those classes in med school at a pretty intense level. But then like energetic anatomy and then more of, things like somatic experiencing and trauma work and things like that. We're sort of being exposed to a lot of those different things, as well as diet and nutrition and movement and various, you know, whether it's yoga exercises or Qigong exercises or Tai Chi exercises, just sort of the movement of the body, et cetera, et cetera. So it was quite remarkable. And, you know, almost something that like every medical school should train people in, but they don't, whether they don't have the time or that's not the focus or whatever that might be. And in the class, you know, you're getting sessions on yourself because you have to practice, right? So you're doing body work, you're getting the body work on you, but then you're also practicing on others. And we would do these sessions where one of the instructors was trained in craniosacral therapy. And essentially what we did is, you know, we were lying on the massage table and we just held each other's cranium. So we just held each other's skull and just essentially were witnesses to what was happening, what we were feeling. And that was probably the most significant moment where this sort of ignition happened for me with the cerebrospinal fluid. The it came from a very resourced perspective. So I felt like I was fairly resourced. I felt like a lot of the training kind of getting to that point was finding our center ground in neutral. So anytime that we actually palpated or made contact with another individual, before making contact with another individual, before we would get a session from another individual, we found our center, we found our neutrality, and we found our ground. So it's sort of like we felt our body making contact with the table. We felt our feet, we felt our body breathing. We felt our neutrality, whatever was going on in life, you know, let's say any stressors, you just kind of tried to put them aside for that period of time. And so we, as a practitioner and also as the person getting the work, you were actually, we were kind of trained to go into this sort of, you know, centering yourself, grounding yourself and becoming neutral. And it was during one of these sessions where essentially I felt like a pulsation, like a movement of energy that was occurring, and it was coming up through my body, through my spine specifically. And because I had gone through medical school, it was kind of like this, you know, like my whole system was primed in terms of even just asking like, oh, what is this? Right. And since I had gone through 2 years of medical school and I was in this, what they call the medical scientist training program, which is essentially, you know, you're I'm about to start my PhD. We're very inquisitive people, and we like to ask questions and form hypotheses and try to design experiments that try to test those hypotheses. And so essentially on the table, right, this is happening, and I'm asking myself, what is this, right? Just mm-hmm. just an open, like, this is an interesting sensation, a sensation that I've never felt before. Never read about it in books. I didn't know about it. All he said was essentially hold your cranium and see what happens, right? It wasn't like, okay, once you do this, then this is going to happen. This is going to, it was just like, you know, totally, exactly. Be totally curious about it, right?
Yeah.
And from a resource place, from a place that you could, be neutral about it and things like that. And so I just simply asked the questions. And just like anything that was in medicine or anything that happens in the human body, reproducibility was important. So that happened the first session. I don't even think I told anybody. Then the next session, I was like, oh, I remember what happened last time, right? Let's see if this happens again without any bias or anything like that. Because I had nothing sort of hanging on this or anything. And it happened again. And I was like, wow, this is interesting. It was very reproducible. And so at first it was pulsating. It felt like there was a rising of an energy, and it was really localizing in my brain, like right in the center of my brain. Sort of if you were to imagine where your third eye would be, but in the middle of your, like literally in the middle of your brain. And that's where this sort of energy, this pulsation would feel like that was coalescing. So it was like rising, and there was sort of this meeting of the energies, and it kind of felt like this sort of pulsation. And when I visualized it, it actually looked like it looked like an eye. Like an eye, almost like I was staring, like a lion's eye or an eagle's eye. Or somebody then, when I was telling this to somebody actually showed me the Egyptian images or the Greek images of the eye of Horus that you find sometimes. And I was like, that's it. Like, that's the eye, right? And so when I would visualize it, so I was using visualization and also felt sense, it was like this coalescing, the sort of pulsation right in the middle of my brain. And I could visualize like this eye sort of watching or present. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. Is this pulsation my heartbeat? Right? Because I knew of certain pulsations in the body, and sort of like, is this pulsation my heartbeat? And so in the moment, I put my hand on my carotid pulse, and it was completely different. There was a different rhythm to the pulsations. And then I just recognized, I put my hands on my chest, and I recognized my breathing. Was I feeling, was there a felt sense of the breathing that was occurring through my chest cavity in my brain? And it was completely different than that. And I was like, wow, this is a sort of a novel rhythm that I had not known about, that I didn't learn in medical school. And so I just sort of paid attention to it, just like what you said, curiously. And because I had gone through, intensive anatomy, physiology, neuroanatomy, where for 2 months we're taking apart brains and things, I just asked, where is this sensation localizing in the brain? And through a process of like, is it this? Is it that? Is it there? Is it there? It kind of feels like it's there. It came like as soon as I, and this was kind of the interesting part, is as soon as I said, is that the third ventricle? There was sort of like this sort of like questioning, right? It was like, oh, is it the third ventricle? Like, right. And the third ventricle is this midline space. So it's a chamber. Imagine the ventricles in the brain as these chambers or caves or cavities in our brain themselves. And the third ventricle is actually perfectly midline. It's midline, and it actually helps separate the two hemispheres of the brain. We have what's called lateral ventricles in each hemisphere of the brain, and it's sort of like these sort of hollow cavities that go from the front of our brain all the way to the back of the brain and sort of circle around. They're quite beautiful anatomically. And the third ventricle, so imagine some people depict it as like wings, like the lateral ventricles being these wings in our hemispheres, and then the third ventricle being like the body of the bird that's flying. So the third ventricle is in the middle.
Vertical?
Vertical. Yep. And as soon as I said third ventricle, there was like this like response. It was like, yes, that, like, that's it. I was like, who is that? You know? And it was sort of like an awakening in essence. Like, like there was something that was responding, right? Like you, like, I, you know, as I have children, it's sort of like, hey, you know, you up? Right. Yeah. And you just wait. And then all of a sudden it's like,
yeah.
Right. And I was like, oh my goodness. Okay.
Hello, God. Right? Yeah.
Hello. And so just from there, I got very interested in that. So that was a very visceral felt sense experience, and it was reproducible. There was a very clear relational energy that was associated with it. And that was very interesting. Was it almost seemed as if it was open to having a relationship, not in terms of like, you know, owning it or controlling it or anything like that, but almost as if, like, I sort of describe it as like, you know, like, oh, hello, you know, like how would you hold a little child, like a 1 day old child or a premature child, for instance, in your hand? Like, how would you hold that? How would you hold that baby in your hand? Right. How would you welcome, a newborn animal, let's say, from the depths of a forest out into a field? How would you approach it? Or if you wanted to be in relationship with it, how would you actually orient yourself to that? Right. And it's very, you're not compressing anything. It's very open. It's very allowing. And that was very interesting to me as well, was that there was this sort of like relational aspect of it. And that was essentially the beginning of, hey, I would like to investigate this further.
Yeah. Would you say that in that holding or the imagining of that holding, it's almost like something that has its own consciousness? And there's, because that's what it sounds like. Like when I imagine a day old baby, which I hold them a lot in my work, it's like there's a recognition and a consciousness there, but not yet a capacity to communicate in the way that I'm typically used to communicating. So,
yes,
right,
yes,
like how you and I are chitty chatting right now, but it's like it knows me, I know it, and it's
yeah, equal. It's not, it was, yes. Yes. And I think, you know, when you say like a consciousness, it seems like it was definitely not separate, right? It wasn't like there wasn't like two. It was like, this was part of me, but not me in essence.
And part of you, but not you. So would that mean that it's part of you, but it's like a bridge to somewhere else?
That's what it felt like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's why, you know, so it was like, oh, this is interesting. What is this? And that's when, you know, that's when sort of the personal exploration started to occur more deeply. But then the also, you know, I think you have to kind of understand my background is that at the end of the day, I'm a physician scientist. And so I kind of want to know what it is. Right. So as soon as I, you know, as soon as the felt sense started to be reproducible, and I started asking, and it started becoming more and more pronounced in the third ventricle, and this sort of energy was really coalescing strongly in the third ventricle, and feeling sort of almost like there was like an electrical energy that was coming through that was causing, it was almost as if the tips of my, like my hair follicles were like electrical stimuli, like little, almost like electrical endings, and they were like right. And I was like, and literally I actually stopped once because I went into the bathroom and I wanted to see if there was ants in my, like, I actually wanted to see if there was bugs crawling in my hair, because that's what it felt like. It literally felt like there was like 1,000 little bugs that were crawling on my scalp. That was the like sort of the electrical sensation of the energy, if you could imagine, like, right? And And so it started becoming more reproducible. And so it was like, oh, well, what's in the third ventricle, right? So I went to my teacher and I said, hey, you know, this is what I'm noticing. And he goes, oh, you must be feeling then the cerebrospinal fluid. And I'm like, oh, well, I know about the cerebrospinal fluid, but I didn't have any sense that, like, what are you talking about? I'm feeling the cerebrospinal, right? Like I didn't know that we could actually feel something in the middle of our brains or anything like that. And so that, I go home and I said, I got to look up what the cerebrospinal fluid is, because I know I've studied it from the medical school texts, right? So I got to look it up. Like, what is this fluid, right? What do we know of this fluid? What's in it? Does it pulsate? You know, what's the science behind it? And that's when I realized that actually there was not much known about it from a scientific perspective. We didn't know much about what was in it. And that was the first key to saying, hey, maybe I could actually, you know, maybe this is actually something that I could do research on, and I could go back to Harvard and find somebody that was interested in the cerebrospinal fluid or brain development or anything like that, and see if I can, you know, if I could study this fluid as a PhD, because now there was a passion behind it, right? And something that I could do as opposed to just something that, you know, oh, here's a project, you can do this project and go. I mean, not to say that that's, you know, not good, but for me, there was just something lacking about that sort of work that, you know, didn't really have a passion behind it. And this, it was a very felt sense. So I got back to Harvard. So we finished our trainings. We continued doing, I was very interested in craniosacral just because it was more about, you know, working with this fluid. We decided to keep on training in craniosacral. So I went back to Harvard with my now wife. We ended up, you know, living together. I proposed this subject to a professor. He said, sounds like a great idea. We've always been studying the cells. It looks like this fluid is really important. Let's start studying the fluid. And that sort of took off. And so it was really amazing, right? Because he actually gave me the space to not only study this fluid, but also every 2.5 months, I was in Boston, right? Every 2.5 months, we would take off and we'd have to go to Boulder to study craniosacral therapy. And so, you know, he was open to that. He's like, okay, you know, if this is going to kind of keep you alive and keep you well, and, you know, you're going to continue doing the work, which is really important work, then, you know, we'll kind of allow you to do this. And so, you know, every 2.5 months, we'd leave for 6 days and go to Boulder and do, you know, craniosacral therapy training. And, you know, so just imagine this while I'm looking through a microscope, trying to like isolate cerebrospinal fluid and trying to understand its molecular consistency, right? I'm also holding people's skulls and looking at it getting sessions myself and kind of palpating and getting the sense of how this fluid is moving, but more from a totally authentic, like, what do I feel, right? As opposed to like, what do the textbooks say? Like, okay, great. That's important to understand. But I really wanted to come from like my own experience as we were studying the fluid from a very biomolecular perspective.
Right. Which in many senses feels removed, because you're not having a felt sense experience like you described, you know, and I think that's often missing from the equation of isolating these things and learning about them and researching them, is like, how do I actually feel what it is to experience this thing, you know, which I guess we can't apply to every single field of research, but to be able to feel it, you know, to sense it in the body, and then to feel it in someone else's body actually moving, you know, from the sacrum up to the top of the head and experiencing it from that different perspective must be so essential for what you're doing now. Like, I can't imagine not having that additional training woven into your research, you know?
It was clear.
Yeah.
Visceral. It became visceral.
Right.
Right. It was a felt sense. And that was really important. Sort of, and that's, you know, I think a lot of the practices I do, and that's what probably why I do the practices that I do or the way that I teach it, is I do teach the anatomy, right? I do teach the anatomy. I teach the physiology. I kind of want people to understand the anatomy and have a felt sense of it for themselves. And that's very important. And so it remains, the practice is embodied. It's not, we don't disassociate, you know, it's fully embodied. And that's important. And there's a part of that embodiment that gets accentuated. There's almost like an increased liveliness to that when we consciously add the knowledge of, for instance, anatomy or physiology into the equation. It's quite powerful.
It is powerful. And you've also described cerebral spinal fluid as a radiant lake. I saw that phrase somewhere, because you look at it as a communicator between parts of the body, between an outside source, you know, speaking with an inside source. So how would you invite us, you know, because we have a conventional perspective of it. I mean, my perspective of CSF is really like through the scope of birth and understanding how epidurals interact with CSF and then, you know, impact the greater experience of labor and birth. And that's something I'd love to get into. But, you know, that's my, you know, kind of singular perspective. And I think most people, it's like, what were those ads in the 90s that were like, you know, if you do ecstasy, like, this is what happens to your cerebral spinal fluid, it dries up, you know, like, that's like what, when I talk to people, that's what most people think of. There is no basic education on what this substance of life really is or means. So, you know, what is the invitation you have from the conventional perspective to how we can see it now?
That's a great question. First of all, you know, again, I come from it from a very scientific perspective. The majority of the work I do, and, you know, if you ask me why, you know, why I even put up my website, it's simply to bring awareness to the cerebrospinal fluid. That's it. As simple as it is. So many people don't realize that they have this fluid in the middle of their brains until something like, let's say, birth happens, or they get meningitis or something like that, you know, and it's like, oh, like, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to take this needle, I'm going to stick it in your back, and we're going to collect this fluid, or we're going to put this medication into you so that you don't feel the contractions of labor, or you don't feel the pain or whatever it might be. And, you know, don't even really have a sense of where those needles are going or where the catheters are going. And so people don't even have awareness of the cerebrospinal fluid. So that's just number one, is from a purely anatomic perspective, right? Take a look at the ventricles. Like, these are hollow, you know, these are hollow cavities in the middle of our brain. This is anatomy, right? If you look at your hand, right, you have a pretty good sense of your hand, let's say, but we don't have a sense of the inside of our brain. We don't, you know, not, people don't recognize that there's hollow cavities inside the middle of our brain is a hollow cavity, right? And so that hollow cavity is filled with cerebrospinal fluid. So just bringing awareness to that, then, right, just from a purely anatomic perspective, when you look at some of the images, right, the cerebrospinal fluid, there's a, from the middle of our brain, it goes all the way down the central canal of our spinal cord. So in the middle of our spinal cord, there's a hollow cavity. It's called the central canal. There's cerebrospinal fluid that's in the middle of that, going all the way down your spinal cord, right? Then on the outside of your brain, it covers the entire outside of your brain. So, you know, your brain is like bobbling in this fluid. It provides buoyancy, but, you know, if I hit my head, my brain will actually sort of shake in the fluid. And it goes all the way down the outside of your spinal cord, all the way down the outside to our sacrum. So we're sitting on this pool of fluid in our sacrum, right? So the spinal cord ends at about lumbar vertebrae 2, but the cerebrospinal fluid comes all the way down into our sacrum, and there's this pool of sacrum of fluid in our sacrum that we're sitting on, right? So just anatomically, say, be aware of it, right? Whoa, I never knew that there was fluid, right? Just sort of like, oh, I never knew that, you know, there was a, like we had a beating heart, you know, when you're a child and you're learning about it, or even pre this, right? Imagine people who were studying the body, you know, many thousands of years ago, being, what's this thing that I'm feeling in the middle of my chest that's beating? Right. Like, and how do you study that? Right. And I was like, wow. And then slowly, you know, then they go through cadavers and dissections of animals or, you know, and maybe they still see the heart as beating in some animals that are killed for food or whatnot. And then, you still slowly start to make these connections, but simply just bringing that awareness. Right. So that's the entryway is just, so this is, you have this, right? We all have this. And then, right, the first thing is essentially just saying, if you want to have a relationship with it, is just saying hello. Now that's it, right? Saying hello and see how or if it responds. Usually when you say hello, coming from a place of, again, neutrality, centeredness, groundedness, right? Those help. And just saying hello and see what happens. Now, if you want to get, people sometimes need like, oh, you know, that's too out there for me. It's like, okay, well, maybe that's too out there for you. If you want to get more scientific about it, then we approach it from a very scientific perspective and look at all the incredible functions that we've learned about over the last 20 years of what this fluid actually does, just from a purely biomechanical perspective, right?
It's crazy to me and that like only 20 years, you know, like in the grand scheme of things.
It's incredible.
It's only 20 years. That's all we know about this?
It's incredible. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. And so from a purely biomolecular perspective, right, this fluid we know has the capacity of what I call transmitting information. This is what the fluid does. It transmits information. Okay. It helps to transmit information. If something gets released into the fluid, and this starts all the way in development when we are not even formed as an embryo yet, and we're like two layers thick of cells. That's it. We're like a flat sheet of cells. Right? Imagine you being like a cake, right? Two sheets, chocolate and ice cream, or chocolate and vanilla. Right? That's when the amniotic fluid starts forming. Okay. And you are completely, those two layers are completely bathed in fluid. From that, the cerebrospinal fluid develops out of the amniotic fluid. All right. And we start to develop form. Okay, so then we start to sort of see a tube forming, which is going to become our spinal cord and our brain. And then our appendages, you know, our arms and legs kind of pop out of this central tube, right? So thinking of it, everything is midline, right? You form a tube around this midline, right? And that's the cerebrospinal fluid. Once the tube comes and fuses, the outside is the amniotic fluid, the inside is the cerebrospinal fluid. Okay. And even from very, 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 very early on in development, the amniotic fluid is getting information from the cells in terms of what to do to differentiate, to make us into a human being. Through development, then there's actually information, whether it's a growth factor or a molecule or a hormone or electrolytes or whatnot, that's being released into the cerebrospinal fluid that's actually giving information to all the cells that are going to become our central nervous system, right? So we know that from development and into the adult, the fluid is a way of transmitting information, right? And that's incredible. Now, there's a number of studies that have looked at, for instance, the transmission of information through the fluid via movement of the fluid, so pulsations within the cavities themselves, right? Through molecules in the fluid, right? A lot of research being done on growth factors that are released into the cerebrospinal fluid. And if you release it into the fluid, and then the fluid brings it to different parts of the brain, the areas that are actually making contact with the fluid are all major regulatory areas for our brain and central nervous system, right? So if you wanted to sort of, if you want to sort of get the majority of the major regulatory areas of the brain, what can you do? Well, you release something into the fluid, and then the fluid disperses it and it bathes the entire. And so you're getting this like almost like a holistic expression of fluid. And this, you know, they've studied this for melatonin is probably one of the most common things that people are familiar with that is released through the pineal gland. And the pineal gland is in the back of the third ventricle. Okay, so if you think of the third ventricle, in the back of the third ventricle, the pineal gland is sitting there, and melatonin is released by the pineal gland into the cerebrospinal fluid, and it diffuses throughout the central, throughout the cerebrospinal fluid, and actually affects our brain and central nervous system. So it's definitely a transmitter of information. Right. Now, the only question then is, right, we know this, right, but what's the spectrum of information that this fluid can transmit, right?
And the spectrum of influence that it has, right? Because, you know, we're
incredible. Absolutely.
Talking about, I mean, it's, for me, you're saying that's the only question. I'm like, there's a lot of questions here. I mean, like if we're looking at gestation, for example, and the amniotic fluid that is informing this fetus as it's going through its developmental stages and the mother's state, right? Let's just look at her state, her nervous system, you know, her capacity to regulate, back, you know, from dysregulation and how she's responding to her environment and her sustained survival state if she's in a sustained state of survival. So all of the information that she is digesting and assimilating is influencing the composition of her fluid. And therefore, you know, as you said, it's now communicating information to exactly. the baby and to the baby's development. So I'm going to go super specific here. Where does this, what can this tell us about the state that we're in during pregnancy, right? Because there's a hyper focus on, you know, vitamins and nutrition and movement and some of the more, what I would consider surface level things that don't have as lasting of an impact as the mother's psycho-emotional state. And, you know, for the people who are more rooted in the evidence and the scientific nature of this process, the psycho-emotional state is completely correlated with the hormonal state of the mother and the levels and the input and output and the information. So it does impact the development of the fetus. Like there is science about it. So what do women need to reflect on, or what would you say is the invitation for them to reflect on, you know, now that they've maybe in pregnancy have become aware of the fluid and understanding this as a communicator, how can they then shift the relationship and where can the focus go?
Well, you know, again, looking at this holistically, you know, there's a lot of reason for, you know, everything from nutrition to movement, which is really, really important for fetal development. Absolutely. Taking this one step further is, I think, from the way I see it, is totally energetically and frequency. So if you were a bath of water, right, what sort of that was, and this water was able to absorb and transmit information or absorb and transmit energy, right? What sort of frequencies would you want to expose that water to in order to maximize health and well-being? Okay. Now, at first, right, if it's your first child, maybe it's different than your second child. Like you said, right, the psychosocial, psycho-emotional part, there's a very powerful survival instinct here. And that when we feel like we're in danger or we feel like we're in survival mode, what happens is that we trigger the sympathetic nervous system. We trigger the fight or flight nervous system, and that's going to have hormonal effects as well with release of cortisol and things like that. And that's going to cause a certain frequency and vibration to the fluid transmitted through the central nervous system, through the autonomic nervous system, right? One of the things to just sort of, if we can, this is why, stress reduction is so important, because I think what it does is it really helps with decreasing that fight or flight response and decreasing the hormones that are flowing through the body, like cortisol and things like that. As well as our heartbeat, our blood pressure, our insulin sensitivity, et cetera, et cetera. It's just like the number of things that are actually affected by stress is quite insane. And so just looking at it from a frequency energetic perspective, right? What are the things that if we feel like we're in survival mode or we feel like we're in danger, what are the resources that we can bring on that help us feel safe, that help us feel grounded, that help us feel okay, right? And going with that, right? So that might be certain foods, it might be certain drinks, whatever it might be, nutrition wise, vitamins, smoothies, juices, whatever it is. But also looking at trying to look at every other frequency and vibration that you're associating yourself with or exposing yourself to, and knowing that there are certain frequencies, like let's say, 5G, or you have your cell phone next to you, or you're using a microwave or something like that, right? So there's certain frequencies that we're exposed to just because of the culture that we live in. But then what can we do to help shift the frequencies that we're constantly exposed to that bring on more, let's say, more holistically well-being frequencies? And that is really personal. It's really individual to people, right? So, what are some things that I recommend, right? You've got to look at your nutrition. You've got to look at your diet. You've got to look at what water you're ingesting. Water is really important because the cerebrospinal fluid is 99% water, right? And your whole body, looking at it, 60-70% of your body is water. And the baby is literally, right, is being made by fluids, is all held by fluids. And the amniotic fluids, they're essentially floating in this fluid bath, right? And so the water that we ingest is very important. And so finding waters that are more healing, mountain spring water is essentially, trying to stay away from anything that's held in plastic, or that's exposed to sun for long periods of time or anything like that. So, those are really important. And then looking at what are the frequency and vibrations, all frequency and vibrations that people react to that feel resourced by. That might be going to the ocean and listening to the waves, or getting into the ocean and feeling the buoyancy of the salt water from the ocean and feeling the rhythms of the ocean on their body. It might just be going to the beach and putting their feet in the sand, or breathing the ocean air. It might be going up into the mountains. It might be a combination of, it might be going out into nature, whatever it is. It might be singing bowls, Tibetan singing bowls, exposing yourself to tuning forks, singing bowls, crystal bowls. It might be even just turning on music that feels soothing, that allows you, that once you listen to it, allows your whole body and the fluids of the body to go into a certain resonance that makes you feel resourced, right? That makes you feel connected, that makes you feel grounded. So whatever that might be, it's very individual for people, but to kind of look at it as I'm being exposed to these frequencies. These frequencies are being transmitted through me, through the water, into my baby, and it's really informing the baby. So what are the frequencies that I want to expose myself to, that I have control over, that I can do so? And going from there. And this may even be, you know, the mom putting their hand on their belly, or the dad putting, you know, or the caretakers, or whoever, you know, the parents, or, you know, siblings, or anything, you know, everything that you could imagine in terms of like a resourcing environment that goes into the frequency and nature that is being transmitted through the amniotic fluid into the belly, and is actually going to inform the frequency and the vibrations that the baby is being exposed to. And you mentioned psychosomatic. You mentioned, you know, as you know, we've got to look at our thoughts and our beliefs and our emotions. And that's why that stress reduction, because a lot of times the thoughts and beliefs and emotions are usually oriented towards some sort of survival, right? We want to survive as a species. We want to survive. And so they're usually stress oriented, and having practices that help decrease that stress, right? Of course, if there's an emergency, we need to take care of the emergency, right? We need to know that that's an emergency. But many of the thoughts that we have, you know, are not, they're not emergencies. They're not something that needs 911 care or anything like that.
Right. I think because of our past experiences, we perceive the cat in the room to be a lion, you know, because of maybe what we've lived. So it might go even deeper into actually some deeper trauma work, so that our stress responses are, the perception of the stress is maybe a little bit more aligned with what's really going on, right?
Exactly.
You know, it's the neuroception. Totally,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That is huge, right? Of even having that bit of discernment.
Right.
Right. Okay. And yet that involves that involves personal practice, right?
Yeah, it does. And when I've worked with women in pregnancy, and you know, some of that comes up, they'll say, "I don't want to do that work right now because it's big, and I don't want to expose the baby to that." But I'm of the belief that the resolution of those things is actually the important information to transmit to the baby. The buildup, the release, and the resolution. That's really valuable information, rather than the holding pattern of the trauma, you know? So of course everyone's figuring it out as they go, but that resolution can be really important. And then it informs, you know, the parenting journey. We come into postpartum much more resourced, you know, because we go through that alchemical cauldron of pregnancy, or should we, you know, choose to accept the mission, we can. And then that actually leads me to, you know, with all of this information, understanding the fluid as a transmitter, you know, with surrogacy, because I've been tapping into that a little bit lately. It's such a hot market, let's say, where, you know, people, the advertising, like even the marketing is like, you have absolutely, you know, as a surrogate, you have absolutely no connection to this child. And I'm like, that's impossible. If the amniotic fluid is actually forming the CSF of the baby, and if information is transmitted through this fluid, which we're learning more and more and more that it is, how is there no connection whatsoever? And it begs the question of who is the biological mother of this child? You know, and I'm always putting polls into my memberships and my trainings with the doulas that I train. And, you know, some people say, no, it's who gave the egg. No, it's who gestated the baby. No, it's both. There's two mothers, right? So it's kind of this existential question is emerging in my world, you know, with this idea that amniotic fluid carries so much power in forming and transmitting life.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. There's no question about that. And, you know, and I mean, I believe there's even studies that have come out. I don't follow this as closely as some of the other studies I follow, but you know, there are, I believe there's maternal cells that are actually found in the baby and baby and, you know, baby cells that are found in the mother. And there's this
microchimerism.
Yeah. That actually happens. Right. So that's number one. The other one is, like you said, like the information, the forming from the fluid, you know, before, as these cells differentiate, there's amniotic fluid, and then there's the yolk sac underneath. And as they differentiate, the amniotic fluid around all this is chorionic fluid, right? So as you are very early, if there's any concern, right, that's why chorionic sampling is done early on in pregnancy, and then amniotic fluid or amniocentesis is done later, because early on, if there's any concern or any of any sort of, you know, genetic issues or anything like that, you do an amnio, you do a chorionic sampling. And that's because the cavity that the child, that the, it's not even a developing embryo yet. I mean, it is, but it's, you know, it's literally, you know, layers thick of cells. Around that is the chorionic cavity, and that's filled with chorionic fluid, and all that, you know, all that fluid is essentially coming from the mother. And then as the baby differentiates and you get the amniotic fluid then becoming the cerebrospinal fluid, right? So in us, and this is actually something interesting, because you may have people in these states of deep meditation or during this healing work have an energetic connection to their embryonic state. And that energetic connection may actually be through the cerebrospinal fluid, again, as this sort of transmitter of information via and directly link into your amniotic fluid, because the amniotic fluid, right, differentiates into the cerebrospinal fluid. So as the cerebrospinal fluid is developing, there's this mix of amniotic fluid and cerebrospinal fluid for a period of time. And then as the fusion occurs and our brain gets fused, then there's a complete separation, but then more amniotic fluid starts to develop. And now we've sort of encased the cerebrospinal fluid inside what's called the neural tube that makes the cavities, the ventricles, and the central canal of the spinal cord. But there is, at the beginning of that, the amniotic fluid and the cerebrospinal fluid are essentially the same fluid. As differentiation occurs, right, now the cells and the choroid plexus, which is the tissue that makes a lot of the cerebrospinal fluid, comes into play, and it starts making more cerebrospinal fluid. The cerebrospinal fluid then starts differentiating from the amniotic fluid. As that starts to happen, the chorionic fluid starts to lessen, because the baby, now the fetus, actually starts increasing in size, and more amniotic fluid needs to be created so that the baby can be in this amniotic fluid, right? So later on in gestation, the baby's floating around in amniotic fluid. That's all the baby is, and it's almost impossible to get any chorionic fluid. But the reason I bring this up is because from a fluid perspective, right, the cerebrospinal fluid in us today has a homeopathic component of the amniotic fluid from when we were just two layers of cells thick, right? And that gets diluted as time goes on, but there's still, right, whether or not we look at it from a very, you know, a vestigial amount of amniotic fluid or a homeopathic quantity, and that may even get more potent, because as some people know, you know, the more something gets diluted in homeopathy, the more it actually might become more potent. And to hold that energy, to hold that information, people may have the experience of, as they're having a relationship with this fluid, that fluid is directly connected to the amniotic fluid in your mother's womb when you were when you weren't even a fetus, when you were, you know, just a couple layers thick of cells. And so that's also a good, you know, even if there's any moments during any meditation or during any healing sessions of going back into the womb, that this fluid can actually be kind of like one of those mediums back to that, but you're still embodied, right? You're still in this body here. And then even think of, right, now the cerebrospinal fluid in the child that you're holding, which came from the fluid that you created and that fluid that you created actually has a homeopathic quality of the amniotic fluid from when you were in the womb, right? So it's multi-generational then from that perspective. And you know, you absolutely, like, it's absolutely important, I think, to look at that and even if we don't know what to do with it, just honor it, right? Say, hey, oh, whoa, okay, that's interesting, right? Now, as I'm bringing awareness to my own cerebrospinal fluid, right? And these are all kind of like, I kind of see them as like gateways, right? When we're doing our own personal work, as we bring awareness to our own cerebrospinal fluid, if you feel comfortable, right? That's just another gateway that you can open. So it's opening then the gateway in your conscious intention from a resource that embodied place, opening that gateway of the portal through to the amniotic fluid.
Yeah, I've done some meditations with clients of mine or students, depending on where they're at in their journey, the pregnancy, and you know, I say, let's look at your birth story. They're like, oh, I don't have access to that information, or I don't remember, or I don't speak to my mother, or whatever it is. And I'm like, well, it's there. So let's just see what comes up. And, you know, it is this, you know, the CSF that is informing, right? Because we're in water, you know, we have the water within us. And I do believe that information is stored, you know, ancestral information is stored just as you described a few minutes ago. And so the images they actually get like flashes of images, or seeing themselves, or hearing certain sounds, or feeling a certain temperature. And, you know, they'll take those images and then maybe, you know, try to corroborate the evidence or the story with someone else who was there, like their father or someone else who was present. And it's accurate. It's lined up so many times. And they'll say, I don't know why, but I saw this person and I remember seeing them through glass and I don't remember being on the other side of glass. And then they'll get the information that they actually were on the other side of glass in the NICU for 4 days. And so, you know, whether it's like the unconscious, right, the imprints of what we perceive through the eyes, or it is information that is being, you know, it's stored in our fluid, right? Where is it stored? That's what we're trying to figure out. Where is it being stored? Is it on the cloud, right? Our cloud, you know, or is it in the CSF? Is the CSF the cloud, you know? So, yeah, so it's remarkable what you say, because I've seen it, you know, in my own petri dish, you know, pun intended, of my clients and my community when we do this work, is that we can recall what was happening during gestation or during our birth experience or in early childhood and infancy. And when we run into challenges with breastfeeding, you know, take me back to the breastfeeding journey. Oh, I don't remember. That was 40 years ago. And then, you know, we actually do end up recalling images and sensations, because the sensations that you feel in those meditations do tell you a lot about what was going down situationally. So it's just remarkable to me. And, you know, and so after that awareness of just, you know, noticing with that spotlight that we have this really powerful transmitter that's flowing through us at every moment, you know, with its own rhythm, how can we then take it a step further, right? You've talked about breath work. You've talked about different practices to maybe activate it. I know that, you know, in the work you were doing personally, you felt that electricity in your scalp, right? You felt all of these sensations. You know, it is an electric pool in a sense. If it's a transmitter, it's electric, right? I mean, I don't know, that's how it works in my brain. But what's the step that we can take now to really become more intimate with it?
Yeah, there's a couple things. First of all, I do want to mention that, you know, if anybody does go back into their story, let's say, and keeps on reliving it in terms of like, if it's not necessarily quote unquote positive, that to understand that as we go back into the story, regardless of what the story is that we are telling ourselves, right? that there's a mechanism here in flow. And because we are here right now doing this work, that the mechanism in flow is actually based in love. And so when we get a lot of us, we kind of like, if we're doing this work and we kind of go back into the story, and even if we know some of the story, or like it was like, oh, that looked like a dark image or something like that. Like, and then we start to kind of make up other stories about it, and it tends to go sometimes negative. That the process, right? That entire process of gestation, of the sperm meeting the egg, of the fertilized egg hitting the womb and embedding in the womb, and the womb bringing it in and saying, yes, hello, come in, right? And then all those steps that I'm talking about in terms of the amniotic fluid, the fluid coming and bathing these cells, and then the cells differentiating and all that, right? All that is done with love. And so if we connect, right? So there's this connection with the actual mechanism that's at work, which is based in love, that can help kind of rewrite the story a little bit if people really feel that and get a felt sense of that mechanism that's still present and that always will be present from infinity to infinity. That mechanism, that underlining mechanism, is love. Now, in terms of various practices, right? So I did something on YouTube. It's 24 sessions. It's called the Awakening Awareness Program. It's free. It's got 24 lectures and 24 meditations, essentially. And it takes somebody through the very basic practice of finding your resource, learning how to titrate, learning how to bring in, you know, because you don't want to go to the bridge, let's say, unless you feel resourced and you feel like you have, some sort of practice that allows you to be present with whatever comes up. And so the whole program essentially takes one through, finding a resource, titrating uncomfortable thoughts, titrating uncomfortable emotions. You know, if all of a sudden you see some image, you know, how do you actually process that? How do you work with that? And doing that before you do any of, you know, before you do any other work, essentially. The other thing is some sort of introspective ability, some sort of introspective quality. Some people are more adapt to this than others. They have it naturally, or they've had it since they were a child and never lost it. They've continued to practice it. But essentially, like, what do we feel from the inside? What do we feel from the inside? Or as we are looking in, right, what are the felt senses that I can actually tap into as I'm noticing, for instance, you know, if I'm bringing my attention to my heart, what are the sensations that I feel, not only from my chest area, but also from the inside out? Right? There's sort of an interoceptive ability that is developed. And this gets into the ability to notice subtle sensations. Because what we're working with is very, very subtle sensations, which more and more people are kind of working with. But and some people have the ability more than others, but it's not something that like you can't do or you've lost. It's something that can be trained. So, for instance, you know, just if you were to take like your finger, for instance, and touch something. Right, you can feel the element of touch, right? And what that feels like. Now, that's one sensation, right? Or you can place your awareness as if your awareness was sitting on the bone of your finger. And what the bone is perceiving as you're making contact with, you know, your mouse or your computer. What is the bone feeling? Right? Or even prior to that, what is the subcutaneous fascia or the subcutaneous tissue feeling from that contact? What is the fat? What is the tiny layer of fat cells feeling? What are the nerves and blood vessels feeling? What are the muscles feeling? And what is the bone feeling? And literally placing your attention in each of those individual layers and seeing if you can notice a perceptual difference from their perspective. Right. And from that, right, from your finger or your hand or your toes or, you know, then we go to bigger areas of the body like your heart, your chest, your abdomen, right? And where we're actually placing our attention or awareness in different organs and asking ourselves, okay, from the perspective of the liver, right, from the perspective of the pancreas, from the perspective of this, and noticing, right, subtle sensations as we do certain practices of what we notice inside the body. And that can be very, 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 because we are, right, what we're trying to do to study this is actually create instruments that can study the movement of the cerebrospinal fluid when we do these, right? That takes a lot of money and a lot of funding and a lot of research, right? But we are that instrument as an N of one. We can be the most sensitive instrument for ourselves, right? And so learning and developing that technique, that tool of being able to do a practice, being able to expose myself, let's say, to a singing bowl, and noticing, right, from the inside all the different sort of happenings from the inside out. Right? And seeing, right, okay, how is my system reacting to this? Is it going towards a sense of homeostasis? Is it going towards a sense of peace? Is it going towards a sense of healing or not? Right? If it's not, where, what, could something be changed, shifted, adjusted? Right? Or is it something from the, is it a thought that came in? And that's why it's important to kind of do that work prior, because it's a thought that comes in that goes, I don't believe in singing bowls. And so that right frequency is never going to affect you in that way, because you're going to have this sort of, there's going to be this sort of resistance from the get-go, right? That's why that needs to be important, because it's sort of like, oh, you know, I just talked to my uncle about this and, you know, he thinks this is all frou-frou. And now all of a sudden you're down that path, right? And then it's essentially, you know, coming into that relationship with the cerebrospinal fluid and then right, breath work is probably one of the major practices where using all the faculties that you've learned, right, you start doing different breath techniques and you start noticing, right, what do I notice? What do I feel inside? Can I actually feel the cerebrospinal fluid moving on the inside? What do I feel in my sacrum? Do I notice anything going up the spine? What do I notice in my third ventricle or third eye? What do I notice from my pineal gland? All right, and so everything then it sort of builds on itself. And for me, right, we get into that sort of it's a whole body, right, connection through the cerebrospinal fluid, through the water element of the cerebrospinal fluid. And if we see it as, right, a mechanism of transmitting information, right, that there's an information transmitter, that there's a conduit, as we bring awareness to the fluid, as we're embodied, right, as we connect to the fluid, that we can learn to activate it, that we can learn to have a relationship with it. And as we're connecting with the fluid, right, again, sort of a bridge, like a portal from our fully differentiated, manifested physical form to an unmanifest, undifferentiated cosmic energy. And we're going, it's almost as if all the senses are turning in and we're having a interoceptive awareness of what's happening inside, right? And we're connecting with, let's say, our fluid body. Now the cerebrospinal fluid is in the midline, and that's where I sort of guide people to go to, but we don't see it just as the cerebrospinal fluid. Now we sort of see it as the water element of the body, right? And now, right, from the cerebrospinal fluid, which is the most water, and it's this central sort of column, right? If I was to draw that, it's this sort of central column all the way down from that to the periphery. Now I have the whole body, fluid from the whole body, then, right? Imagine like there's this crystalline light that connects cosmic consciousness, cosmic energy, you know, divine God to us through the fluid. And that we can develop a relationship with it, and that it's two ways. It's differentiating and it's undifferentiating. It's manifesting and it's unmanifesting. It's infinite and it's finite. Right? And it's constantly in motion. It's constantly in flux. And there's this constant relationship. And we're never disconnected from it. We might not be aware of it or conscious of it, but we're never disconnected from it. And as we then start to have a relationship with it, it starts to become more present in your life. And it's a place where, you know, it's a place of divine healing.
A lot becomes possible.
I mean, a lot becomes possible.
Yeah.
It's felt, right? It's and you know it. It's like there's a greater knowing than anybody tell, you know, there's a greater knowing than anybody opening up a book and reading about it, or, you know, saying like, you know, these people used to practice it and this is what they, it's beyond mental knowledge.
Yeah. And this is where we come into contact with that, or rub up against, you know, the conflict with accepting the unseen, you know, and grappling with that concept of the unseen, which challenges a lot of the way that we are taught to be in the world.
Absolutely. You know, but if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, for instance, and you look at the visible light frequencies that we can see with our eyes, right? That is a tiny percentage of the entire electromagnetic spectrum that we can see, right? So what you want to develop then is this capacity to hold it all, because we are all, right? And anytime there's even the slightest bit of limitation, then you're limiting the whole. Be no limit, no limitation, no limit, no leaving anything out. It's got to be all. And that's the relationship as well.
Wow. Yeah, it's so many things come to my awareness as you're talking about this, and memories and all kinds of snippets of conversations I've had and recollections. It's really just so powerful, you know. and noticing that even when I go to bodies of water, I have experiences or downloads, right? And where does it come from? You know, where is this coming from? And we can always just, we have the opportunity to reflect on the possibility that we're downloading, because that we have the fluid within us, we have the water within us. And when we come into contact with other bodies of water and other beings who also have the water, you know, we can go deeper into communication, that types of communication that we've never even fathomed we could have with other people, beings,
yes,
and water.
Yes, so. Yes. And as a receiver, right, like it, like when you're talking, right, some people, including yourself, may have that capacity more naturally to be a receiver, to be an antenna, right? And if you think about it, right, when even in our car, right, if I wanted to listen to, let's say, 7:10 a.m., I turn the dial and then I get the information that's coming in from that frequency. But all those frequencies are out there. Right. It's not like all of a sudden, like, oh, now that frequency is being transmitted. No, all those frequencies are out there on the radio. I just tune the dial. They're all out there. Right. So that's the same thing with us. Right. So some people don't have that capacity to tune in. And so it's like, it's way too much information. And so need to learn how to actually modulate that, where others actually have that capacity to modulate, right? Hey, I'm going to go from 7:10 to 6:90. Well, guess what? On the radio, you're going to hear a different tune, right? That's exactly. So it's like this totality, and certain people are just greater antennas. They're more sensitive to that information and they can perceive it and interpret it, right? Then there's the interpretation of it. Okay. And you might be more capable of doing that. And so therefore, you know, even teaching people how to do that or helping people in terms of, look, I'm getting this information and let me just tune, right? Let me tune the dial, right? And I keep on tuning. Or, you know what? I do want to get 3-4 channels at the same time or all the channels. Because why? Because I've actually trained myself to hold all the channels, right? And it's not too much information, right? So that's kind of an analogy that also is, you know, if it's sort of like, oh, you know, like I go into these bodies, yeah, like, what are you tuning into, right, in those bodies of water as you're there? Now the frequencies, they're all there. They're all out there, right? And so our own sensitivity, our own openness, our own curiosity is all a factor that's in these. And the more resourced we are in terms of like, oh, I'm really curious about this, right? Oh my goodness, this looks like a really dark dungeon that I'm going to go into. Okay, I'm really curious about this, right? I know I'm resourced. Let's go into it.
Yeah. I want to ask you one, well, this is a question I wanted to ask you earlier, but when we infuse CSF with something, let's just say an epidural, for example. How does it travel? What's its life cycle, right? You know, if it's not information, right, the unseen, if it's an actual substance, what is the life cycle that it goes through? Because there's schools of thought that, you know, whatever you put into the cerebral spinal fluid doesn't ever reach the rest of the body. And then there's people who say that it does. But what does that life cycle look like?
Well, a lot of it depends on the molecule that you're putting into it, but it gets absorbed. I mean, the cerebrospinal fluid we know gets absorbed by the myelin that's covering the neurons. It gets absorbed by the neurons. If it doesn't get absorbed, it goes into our venous blood supply. So you're definitely transmitting that throughout the entire body, and it's getting absorbed into the myelin and it's getting absorbed into the nervous system. At the most basic level, you are transmitting that throughout the whole body. Do certain people need it? Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, but then knowing that, right, and knowing that, for instance, some people don't feel it, don't feel the effects. And is that, again, you know, for their body, or are they not attuned to it or something like that? You know, the people that I have spoken to, you know, will say that, for instance, and you know, you might have a different answer than me, but, you know, that they notice it's kind of lingering for up to 6 months, or even longer. And so if you notice that, right, so that's where those practices that you can do, and, you know, especially if you're a new mom or a new parent or, you know, a new caregiver or anything like that, any practices where, you know, you're just bringing in, you're playing soothing music and you're allowing that soothing music to bathe you, to come into you, right? You're being touched by somebody who cares, right? Whether it's you or somebody else, or, you know, or a postpartum doula, or, you know, somebody who just comes over and holds your child in a loving way, you know, your grandparents, whatever it might be. And you rest in that, right? Where you're drinking good water, where you're doing breathing exercises that can be very, very subtle, just in terms of taking deep breaths and knowing that with the movement of the breath, as you are consciously taking deep breaths, even diaphragmatic breathing, not intense diaphragmatic breathing, like, you know, just gentle, where it's gentle diaphragmatic breathing, where you're just kind of activating the abdominal wall, or deep abdominal breathing, when you know that, and then you're bringing their awareness into, hey, I know I got an epidural. I had to do it, right? For whatever reason. Right. But now let me now consciously put into play things that I know that will move the cerebrospinal fluid. And just like if there was a slight toxin put into a river, if the river stops flowing, the toxin will be present. But if it doesn't, and it will slowly diffuse into the ground, right, which will happen. But if we move the river, if all of a sudden we open the dam, and the river flows, right, which we can actually consciously do, now you are actually enhancing the movement of that, of the, you know, whatever was in the epidural. So movement, right, even going for a walk, sleep is really important, which a lot of moms or parents or caretakers don't really get good sleep, or that's not their focus, right? Because it's like, oh my God, I can't sleep. My baby's, you know, it's like, if I don't hear my baby breathing, I think they're dead, you know, or whatever. It's like, you know, and so you don't get sleep, right? Because it's like you relax. And then as soon as you relax, you wake up because you're sort of in a fight or flight response. And so trying to get sleep moves the cerebrospinal fluid, right? Breath work moves the cerebrospinal fluid, parasympathetic activities, mindfulness, meditation, listening to soothing music, having caretakers, right? Postpartum doulas, touch, you know, all those things can help accentuate the movement of the fluid so that you're clearing it out, right? So instead of 6 months, it's 2 months or 1 month or whatever it might be. And you're enhancing the flow of the cerebrospinal fluid to help remove the toxins. That's it.
And I would imagine that in that process of creating that flow of the river, there's also the emotional flow of the experience that comes along with that too, you know? Totally. Because we're just turning the energy inward, and by, you know, naturally, the outcome of that is that a lot of it is processed. The birth itself is processed, which is an important thing to do. And that's why you said the postpartum doula, the caretakers, when we get the opportunities to rest, reflect, restore, we can move that experience more fluidly through us rather than it being in a stagnant river. So I see the benefit to it in many regards. Thank you so much. This has been like one of my favorite conversations. It's just, you bring so much amazing light and energy and information to the world. So just thank you. Thank you for your work and all of this knowledge.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's really an honor, and you're doing excellent work, so continue.
Thank you.